beside me on the stoop.
Artists are different from other people.
No, they're not. My face flushed. I had always been different. I did not want to be any more different.
But they are.
He tapped my knee.
You must be ruthless, Lucy.
Chrissy jumped up and down. It's a sad story, she said. I can't read yet. I can read some words, but it's a sad story.
May I read it?
Jeremy asked me this. I said no. I told him I could not bear it if he didn't like it.
He nodded and said, Okay, I won't ask again. But Lucy, he said, you talk to me a lot. And I can't imagine reading anything by you that I wouldn't like.
I remember clearly that he said ruthless. He did not seem ruthless, and I did not think I was or could be ruthless. I loved him. He was gentle. He told me to be ruthless. One more thing about Jeremy. The AIDS epidemic was new. Men walked the streets, bony and gaunt, and you could tell they were sick with this sudden, almost biblical-seeming plague. And one day, sitting on the stoop with Jeremy, I said something that surprised me. I said, after two such men had just walked slowly by, I know it's terrible of me, but I'm almost jealous of them. Because they have each other, they're tied together in a real community. And he looked at me then, and with real kindness on his face. And I see now that he recognized what I did not, that in spite of my plenitude, I was lonely. Lonely was the first flavor I had tasted in my life, and it was always there. Hidden inside the crevices of my mouth, reminding me. He saw this that day, I think, and he was kind.
Yes, is all he said. He could easily have said, Are you crazy? They're dying.
But he did not say that, because he understood that loneliness about me. This is what I want to think. This is what I think. In one of those clothing shops New York is famous for, one of those places privately owned and sort of like the art galleries of Chelsea, I found a woman who turned out to affect me a great deal, who may, in ways I don't understand fully, be the reason I have written this. It was many years ago now. My girls would have been perhaps 11 and 12. In any event, I saw this woman in this clothing store, and I felt certain she hadn't seen me. She had the sort of ditzy look you seldom see on women anymore, and she was attractive with it, wore it very well, and she was, I would have said, almost 50 years old. She was attractive in many ways, stylish, and her hair, ash is the color we used to call it, was well done, by which I mean I understood the color to have come not from a bottle, but from the hands of a person trained to work in a salon. And yet it was her face I was drawn to. Her face, which I watched in the mirror while I tried on a black jacket, and finally I said, Do you think this works? Her look was surprised, as though she had no idea someone would ask her opinion on clothes. Oh, I don't work here. I'm sorry, she said. I told her I understood that. I only wanted her opinion. I told her I liked the way she dressed.
Oh, okay. You do?
Well, thanks. Wow. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah. She must have seen me tugging on the lapels of the jacket I had asked her about. It's nice. That is nice. Are you going to wear it with that skirt? We discussed the skirt and whether or not I owned a longer skirt. Just in case, as she put it, I might want to wear heels, you know, a little pickup. She was as beautiful as her face, I thought. And I loved New York for this gift of endless encounters. Perhaps I saw the sadness in her, too. This is what I felt when I got home and her face went through my mind. It would be something you didn't know you saw at the time, as she smiled a great deal and it made her face sparkle. She had the look of a woman who had men still falling in love with her. I said, "What do you do?" "For a job?" "Yes," I said. "You just look like you do something interesting. Are you an actress?" I put the jacket back on the hanger. I did not have the money to buy such a thing. "Oh, no, no," she said. And then she said, and I swear I saw her color rise, "I'm just a writer, that's all." As though she might as well confess, because, I sensed, she had been caught before. Or perhaps being just a writer was all she thought it was. I asked her what she wrote, and then her color clearly did rise, and she waved her hand and said, "Oh, you know, books, fiction, things like that. It doesn't matter, really." I had to ask her name, and again I had the sense I'd caused her great embarrassment. She said in one breath, "Sarah Payne." And I didn't want to cause her embarrassment, so I thanked her for her advice, and she seemed to relax, and we spoke of where to get the best shoes. She was wearing a pair of black patent leather high heels, and that made her happy, I thought. And then we parted, each of us saying how nice it had been to meet the other. At home in our apartment, we had moved by then to Brooklyn Heights, and as the children ran about, shouting, "Where was the hairdryer?" or "the blouse that had been in the laundry?" I looked through our bookshelves, and I saw that Sarah Payne looked only a little bit like her jacket photo. I had read her books. And then I remembered being at a party with a man who knew her. He spoke of her work, saying that she was a good writer, but that she could not stop herself from a softness of compassion that revolted him, that, he felt, weakened her work. Still, I liked her books. I like writers who try to tell you something truthful. I also liked her work because she had grown up on a run-down apple orchard in a small town in New Hampshire, and she wrote about the rural parts of that state. She wrote about people who worked hard and suffered and also had good things happen to them. And then I realized that even in her books, she was not telling exactly the truth. She was always staying away from something. Why, she could barely say her name. And I felt I understood that, too. In the hospital that next morning, now so many years ago, I told my mother I was worried about her not sleeping. And she said that I shouldn't worry about her not sleeping, that she had learned to take cat naps all of her life. And then, once more, there began that slight rush of words, the compression of feeling that seemed to push up through her as she started that morning to suddenly speak of her childhood, how she had taken cat naps throughout her childhood, too. "You learn, too, when you don't feel safe," she said. "You can always take a cat nap sitting up." I know very little about my mother's childhood. In a way, I think this is not unusual, to know little of our parents' childhoods, I mean, in a specific way. There is now a large interest in ancestry, and that means names and places and photos and court records, but how do we find out what the daily fabric of a life was? I mean, when the time comes that we care. The Puritanism of my ancestors has not made use of conversation as a source of pleasure, the way I have seen other cultures do. But that morning in the hospital, my mother seemed pleased enough to speak of the summers she had gone to live on a farm. She had spoken of that in the past. For whatever reasons, my mother spent most of her childhood summers on the farm owned by her Aunt Celia, a woman I have remembered only as a thin, pale person, and whom I, as well as my brother and sister, called Aunt Seal. At least in my head, I always thought that was who she was, Aunt Seal. And there was confusion about that, because children are literal thinkers. And I had no idea why she would be named after an animal from the ocean I had never seen. She was married to Uncle Roy, who was, as far as I knew, a very nice man. My mother's cousin, Harriet, was their only child, and her name was the one that came up periodically throughout my youth. "I was thinking," my mother said, in her soft, rushed voice, "how one morning, oh, we must have been little, maybe I was 5 and Harriet 3, I was thinking how we decided to help Aunt Celia take the deadheads off the lemon lilies that grew by the barn. But of course, Harriet was just a little thing, and she thought the big buds were the dead parts to take off, and there she was, snapping them right off when Aunt Celia came out." "Was Aunt Seal mad?" I asked. "No, I don't remember that. But I was," my mother said. "I'd tried to tell her what was a bud and what wasn't. Stupid child." "I never knew Harriet was stupid. You never said she was stupid." "Well, maybe she wasn't. She probably wasn't. But she was afraid of everything. She was so afraid of lightning, she would go hide under the bed and whimper," my mother said. "I never understood it. And so frightened of snakes. Such a silly girl, really." "Mom, please don't say that word again. Please." Already I was trying to sit up and raise my feet. Even now, I always feel the need to get my feet up where I can see them, should I hear that word. "Say what word again? Snakes?" "Mom!" "For heaven's sake, I don't..." "All right, all right." She waved a hand and gave a little shrug as she turned to look out the window. "You've often reminded me of Harriet," she said, "that silly fear of yours. And your ability to feel sorry for any Tom, Dick, or Harry that came along." I still do not know, even now, what Tom, Dick, or Harry I'd felt sorry for, or when they'd come along. "But I want to hear," I said. I wanted to hear her voice again, her different, rushed voice. Toothache, the nurse, walked into the room. She took my temperature, but she did not look into space the way Cookie did. Instead, Toothache looked at me carefully, then looked at the thermometer, and then told me that the fever was the same as it had been the day before. She asked my mother if she wanted anything, and my mother shook her head quickly. For a moment, Toothache stood, her woebegone face seeming at a loss. Then she measured my blood pressure, which was always fine, and it was fine that morning. "All right, then," said Toothache, and both my mother and I thanked her. She wrote a few things on my chart, and at the door she turned to say that the doctor would be in soon. "The doctor seemed like a nice man," my mother said, addressing the window, "when he came in last night." Toothache glanced back at me as she left. After a moment, I said, "Mom, tell me more about Harriet." Well, you know what happened to Harriet.
My mother returned to the room, to me. I said, but you always liked her, though, right?
Oh, sure. What was there not to like about Harriet? She had that very poor luck with her marriage. She married a man from a couple towns away she met at a dance, a square dance in a barn, I think. And people were pleased for her, you know. She wasn't a great deal to look at, even back then in the prime of her youth.
What was wrong with her? I asked.
Nothing was wrong with her. She was just always fretful, even as a young girl, and she had those buck teeth, and she smoked, which gave her bad breath. But she was a sweet thing. She was that. Never meant harm to anyone, and she had those two kids, Abel and Dottie.
Oh, I loved Abel when I was a kid, I said.
Yes, Abel was just a wonderful person, always. Funny how that can happen. Out of nowhere, a tree rises up strong, and that's what he was. Anyway, one day Harriet's husband went out to get her cigarettes and
never came back, I finished.
I should say he never came back. I should say he indeed never came back. He dropped dead on the street, and Harriet had such a time trying to keep the state from taking those kids. He left her nothing, poor woman. I'm sure he didn't expect to just die. They were living in Rockford by then. You know, it's over an hour away. And she stayed there. I never knew why. But she would send the kids to us a few weeks each summer, once we were in the house.
Oh, such sad-looking children. I'd always try and make Dottie a new dress to send her home with. Abel Blaine. His pants were too short, above his ankles, I remember. And kids laughed at him when we went into town. And he always smiled as though none of it mattered. His teeth were crooked and bad, but otherwise he was nice-looking. Perhaps he knew that he was nice-looking. I think, really, his heart was just good. He was the one who taught me to search for food from the dumpster behind Chatwin's cake shop. What was striking was the lack of furtiveness he displayed as he stood in the dumpster and tossed aside boxes until he found what he was looking for, the old cakes and rolls and pastries from days before. Neither Dottie nor my own sister and brother were ever with us. I don't know where they were. After a few visits to Amgash, Abel did not come back. He had a job as an usher in a theater where he lived. He sent me one letter and enclosed a brochure that showed the theater's lobby. It was just beautiful, I remember, with many different colored tiles, ornate and gorgeous.
Abel landed on his feet, my mother told me.
Tell me again, I said.
He managed to marry the daughter of someone he worked for. The boss's daughter story, I guess, is his story. He lives in Chicago, has for years, my mother said. His wife's quite a hoity-toity and won't have anything to do with poor Dottie, whose husband ran off with someone else a few years ago now. He was from the East, Dottie's husband, you know.
No.
Well, my mother sighed. He was. Somewhere here along the eastern seaboard he came from.
My mother gave a small toss of her head toward the window as though to indicate this was where Dottie's husband came from.
Thought he was just a tiny bit better than she was, probably.
Whizzle, how can you live with no sky?
There's sky. But I added, except I know what you mean. But how can you live without sky?
There's people instead, I said.
So tell me why. Why what?
Why did Dottie's husband run off?
How do I know? Oh, I guess I do know. He met some woman at the local hospital when he had his gallbladder out. Say, that's almost like you.
Like me? You think I'm going to run off with Cookie or Serious Child?
You never know what attracts people to each other, my mother answered. But I don't think he ran off with any toothache. My mother tilted her head in the direction of the door. Though he may have run off with a child, I'm sure she's not a serious child, you know. I mean, my mother leaned forward to whisper, dark, or whatever ours is, you know, Indian. My mother sat back. But I'm rather sure she's younger than Dottie and more attractive. He left Dottie the house they lived in, and she's turned it into a bed and breakfast. Doing all right, as far as I know. And Abel's in Chicago doing more than all right, so good for poor Harriet after all. Well, I suppose she'd worried about Dottie. My word, Harriet worried about everyone. Not worrying now, though, I guess. She's been dead for years. Like that, in her sleep one night. Not a bad way to go. I dozed on and off, listening to my mother's voice. I thought, all I want is this. But it turned out I wanted something else. I wanted my mother to ask about my life. I wanted to tell her about the life I was living now. Stupidly. It was just stupidity. I blurted out, Mom, I got 2 stories published. She looked at me quickly and quizzically, as if I had said I had grown extra toes. Then she looked out the window and said nothing. Just dumb ones, I said, in tiny magazines. Still she said nothing. Then I said, Becca doesn't sleep through the night. Maybe she gets it from you. Maybe she'll take cat naps, too. My mother kept looking out the window. But I don't want her to not feel safe, I added. Mom, why didn't you feel safe? My mother closed her eyes, as though the very question might drop her into a nap. But I did not think for 1 minute she had gone to sleep. After many moments, she opened her eyes, and I said to her, I have a friend, Jeremy. He used to live in France, and his family was part of the aristocracy. My mother looked at me, then looked out the window, and it was a long time before she said, So he says, and I said, Yes, so he says, in a tone of apology and in a way that let her know we need not discuss him or my life any further. Right then, through my doorway, came the doctor. Girls, he said, and nodded. He went and shook my mother's hand, as he had the day before. How's everyone today? Immediately he swooshed the curtain around me, and this separated me from my mother. I loved him for many reasons, and one reason was for that. How he made his visits private for the two of us. I could hear my mother's chair move, and I knew she'd left the room. The doctor held my wrist to take my pulse, and when he gently lifted my hospital gown in order to check the scar, as he did each day, I watched his hands, thick-fingered and lovely, his plain gold wedding band glinting, pressing gently on the area near the scar, and he looked into my face to see if it hurt. He asked by raising his eyebrows, and I'd shake my head. The scar was healing nicely. Healing nicely, he said. And I said, Yes, I know. And we'd smile, because it seemed to mean something, that it was not the scar trying to keep me sick. The smile was our acknowledgement of something. Is what I mean. I have always remembered this man, and for years I gave money to that hospital in his name. And I thought then, and I think now still, of the phrase, the laying on of hands. The truck. At times it comes to me with a clarity I find astonishing. The dirt-streaked windows, the tilt of the windshield, the grime on the dashboard, the smell of diesel gas and rotting apples and dogs. I don't know in numbers how many times I was locked in the truck. I don't know the first time, I don't know the last time. But I was very young, probably no more than 5 years old the last time, otherwise I'd have been in school all day. I was put there because my sister and brother were in school, this is my thought now, and my parents were both working. Other times I was put there as punishment. I remember saltine crackers with peanut butter, which I couldn't eat because I was so frightened. I remember pounding on the glass of the windows, screaming. I did not think I would die. I don't think I thought anything. It was just terror, realizing that no one was to come, and watching the sky get darker and feeling the cold start in. Always, I screamed and screamed. I cried until I could hardly breathe. In this city of New York, I see children crying from tiredness, which is real, and sometimes from just crabbiness, which is real. But once in a while, I see a child crying with the deepest of desperation, and I think it is one of the truest sounds a child can make. I feel almost, then, that I can hear within me the sound of my own heart breaking, the way you could hear outside in the open air, when the conditions were exactly right, the corn growing in the fields of my youth. I have met many people, even from the Midwest, who tell me that you cannot hear the corn growing. And they are wrong. You cannot hear my heart breaking, and I know that part is true. But to me they are inseparable, the sound of growing corn and the sound of my heart breaking. I have left the subway car I was riding in, so I did not have to hear a child crying that way. My mind went very strange places during these episodes of being in the truck. I thought I saw a man coming toward me. I thought I saw a monster. I thought one time I saw my sister. Then I would calm myself and say aloud to myself, "It's okay, sweetie. A nice woman's going to come soon, and you're a very good girl. You're such a good girl, and she's a relative of Mommy's, and she'll need you to go live with her because she's lonely and wants to have a nice little girl to live with." I would have this fantasy, and it was very real to me. It kept me calm. I dreamed of not being cold, of having clean sheets, clean towels, a toilet that worked, and a sunny kitchen. I allowed myself into heaven this way. And then the cold would come in, and the sun would go down, and my crying would start again, as a whimper, then more forcefully. And then my father would show up, unlock the door, and sometimes he carried me. "No reason to cry," he sometimes said. And I can remember the feel of his warm hand spread against the back of my head. The doctor, who wore his sadness with such loveliness, had come to check on me the night before. "I had a patient on another floor," he said. "Let me see how you're doing." And he swished the curtain around me as he always did. He didn't take my temperature with a thermometer, but held his hand to my forehead, and then took my pulse with his fingers to my wrist.
"Okay, then," he said. "Sleep well."
He made a fist and kissed it, then held it in the air as he unswished the curtain and left the room. For many years, I loved this man. But I have already said that. Other than Jeremy, the only friend I had in the village during this time in my life was a tall Swedish woman named Mala. She was at least 10 years older than I, but she also had small children. She passed by our door one day with her kids on the way to the park, and she started talking to me right away about really personal things. Her mother had not treated her well, she said, and so when she had her first baby, she became very sad, and her psychiatrist told her that she was feeling grief because of everything she had not received from her own mother, etc. I didn't disbelieve her, but her story wasn't what was interesting to me. It was her style, her forthright spilling out about things I didn't know people spoke of. And she was not really interested in me, which was freeing. She liked me. She was nice to me. She was bossy and told me how to hold my babies and how to get them to the park, and so I liked her back. Mostly she was like watching a movie or something foreign, which of course she was. She made references to movies, and I never knew what she was talking about. She must have noticed this, and she was polite about it. Or maybe she did not believe that I could have a blank face when she spoke of Bergman films or television shows from the 60s, or music, too. I had no knowledge of popular knowledge, as I have said. At that time, I barely understood that about myself. My husband knew it about me and would try to help me out if he was around, maybe saying, "Oh, my wife didn't see a lot of movies growing up. Don't worry." Or, "My wife's parents were strict and never let her watch television." Not giving away my childhood of poverty, because even poor people had TVs. Who would have believed it? "Mommy?" I said softly that next night.
"Yes?"
"Why did you come here?" There was a pause, as though she was shifting her position in the chair, but my head was turned toward the window. "Because your husband called and asked for me to come. He needed you babysat, I believe." For a long while there was silence. Maybe it was 10 minutes. Maybe it was almost an hour. I really don't know. But finally I said, "Well, thank you anyway." And she did not reply. In the middle of the night, I woke from a nightmare I could not remember. Her voice came quietly, "Whistle-dee, sleep. Or if you can't sleep, just rest. Please rest, honey." "You're never sleeping," I said, trying to sit up. "How can you go every night never sleeping? Mom, it's been 2 nights."
"Don't worry about me," she said. She added, "I like your doctor. He's watching out for you. The residents know nothing, how can they? But he's good. He'll see to it that you get better."
"I like him, too," I said. "I love him." A few minutes later, she said, "I'm sorry we had so little money when you kids were growing up. I know it was humiliating." In the dark, I felt my face become very warm. "I don't think it mattered," I said.
"Of course it mattered.
But we're all fine now."
"I'm not so sure,"
she said this thoughtfully. "Your brother is almost a middle-aged man who sleeps with pigs and reads children's books. And Vicky, she's still mad about it. The kids made fun of you at school. Your father and I didn't know that. I suppose we should have. Vicky's really still pretty mad."
At you?
Yes, I think so.
That's silly, I said.
No. Mothers are supposed to protect their children.
After a while, I said, Mom, there are kids with mothers who sell them for drugs. There are kids whose mothers take off for days and just leave them. There are...
I stopped. I was tired of what was sounding untrue.
She said, You were a different kind of kid from Vicky, and from your brother, too. You didn't care as much what people thought.
What makes you say that? I asked.
Well, look at your life right now. You just went ahead and did it.
I see. I didn't see, though. How do we ever see something about our own self?
When I went to school when I was little, I said, lying flat on my back on the hospital bed, the lights from the buildings showing through the window, I'd miss you all day. I couldn't talk when a teacher called on me, because I had a lump in my throat. I don't know how long it lasted, but I missed you so much, sometimes I'd go into the bathroom to cry.
Your brother threw up.
I waited for a moment. Many moments went by. Finally, she said, Every morning before school in fifth grade, your brother threw up. I never found out why.
Mom, I said, what children's books does he read?
The ones about the little girl on the prairie. There's a series of them. He loves them. He's not slow, you know.
I turned my eyes toward the window. The light from the Chrysler Building shone like the beacon it was, of the largest and best hopes for mankind, and its aspirations and desire for beauty. That was what I wanted to tell my mother about this building we saw.
I said, Sometimes I remember the truck.
The truck? My mother's voice sounded surprised.
I don't know anything about a truck, she said.
What do you mean? Your father's old Chevy truck?
I wanted to say, oh, terribly I wanted to say, not even when there was the really, really long brown snake in there with me one time. I wanted to ask her this, but I could not bear to say the word. Even now I can barely stand to say the word. And to tell anyone how frightened I was when I saw that I had been locked into a truck with such a long brown...
And he moved so quickly. So quickly.
When I was in the sixth grade, a teacher arrived from the East. His name was Mr. Haley, and he was a young man. He taught us social studies. There are two things I remember about him. The first is that one day I had to go to the bathroom, which I hated to do because it called attention to me. He gave me the pass, nodding once, smiling. When I returned to the room and approached him to return the pass, it was a large block of wood that we were required to hold in the corridor to prove that we had permission to be out of the classroom. When I handed him back the pass, I saw Carol Darr, a popular girl, do something, a kind of hand gesture or something that I knew from experience was making fun of me, and she was doing it toward her friends so they could make fun of me as well. And I remember that Mr. Haley's face became red, and he said, Do not ever think you are better than someone.
I will not tolerate that in my classroom. There is no one here who is better than someone else. I have just witnessed expressions on the faces of some of you that indicate you think you are better than someone else, and I will not tolerate that in my classroom. I will not. I glanced at Carol Darr. In my memory, she was chastened. She felt bad. I fell silently, absolutely, immediately in love with this man. I have no idea where he is, if he is still alive, but I still love this man. The other thing about Mr. Haley was that he taught us about the Indians. Until then, I hadn't known that we took their land from them with a deception that caused Black Hawk to rebel. I didn't know that the whites gave them whiskey, that the whites killed their women in their own cornfields. I felt that I loved Black Hawk as I did Mr. Haley, that these were brave and wonderful men, and I could not believe how Black Hawk was taken on a tour of cities after his capture. I read his autobiography as soon as I could, and I remembered the line he said, "How smooth must be the language of the whites when they can make right look like wrong, and wrong like right." I worried, too, that his autobiography, which had been transcribed by an interpreter, would not be accurate, and so I wondered, who is Black Hawk, really? And I got a sense of him as strong and bewildered, and when he spoke of our great father, the president, he used nice terms, and that made me sad. All of this, I am saying, made a huge impression on me, the indignities that we had forced onto these people. And when I came home from school one day, after we learned how the Indian women planted a field of corn and the white men came and plowed it up, my mother was in front of our garage home, which we had only recently moved out of. She may have been trying to fix something, I don't recall, but she was squatting by the front door, and I said to her, "Mommy, do you know what we did to the Indians?" I said this slowly and with awe. My mother wiped at her hair with the back of her hand. "I don't give a damn what we did to the Indians," she said. Mr. Haley left at the end of the year. In my memory, he was going into the service, and this could only have been Vietnam since it was during that time. I have since looked up his name on the Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and it isn't there. I don't know anything more about him, but in my memory, Carol Darr was all right to me, in his class, after that. We all liked him, is what I mean. We all respected him. This is no small feat for a man with a classroom of 12-year-olds to accomplish, but he did. Over the years, I have thought about the books that my mother said my brother was reading. I'd read them, too. They hadn't touched me too deeply. As I said, my heart was with Black Hawk, and not with these white people who lived on the prairie. And so I have thought about these books. What was it in them that my brother liked? The family of this series was a nice family. They made their way across the prairie. They were sometimes in trouble, but always the mother was kind and the father loved them very much. My daughter Chrissy has turned out to love these books as well. When Chrissy turned 8, I bought her the book about Tilly that had meant so much to me. Chrissy loved to read. I was happy to have her unwrap this book. She unwrapped it at a birthday party I had for her, and her friend, whose father was a musician, was there. When he came to pick his daughter up after the party, he stayed and talked, and he mentioned the artist I had known in college. The artist had moved to New York not long after I had. I said that I knew him. The musician said, "You're prettier than his wife."
No, he said when I asked. The artist had no children. A few days later, Chrissy said to me about the book with Tilly in it, Mom, it's kind of a dumb book. But the books my brother loved about the girl on the prairie, Chrissy still loves those books, too. On the third day that my mother sat at the foot of my bed, I could see the fatigue on her face. I didn't want her to leave, but she seemed unable to accept the nurse's offer to bring in a cot, and I felt she would leave soon. As has often been the case with me, I began to dread this in advance. I remember my first dreading in advance as having to do with the dentist of my childhood. Because we had little dental care in our youth, and because genetically we were thought to have soft teeth, any trip to the dentist was quite naturally filled with dread. The dentist provided free care in a manner that was ungenerous, both in time and manner, as though he hated us for being who we were, and I worried the entire time once I heard I would have to see him. It was not often that I saw him, but early on I saw this. You are wasting time by suffering twice. I mention this only to show how many things the mind cannot will itself to do, even if it wants to. It was Sirius Child who came for me in the middle of the next night, saying that blood tests had come back from the lab and I needed a CAT scan immediately. But it's the middle of the night, my mother said. Sirius Child said I had to go. And so I said, let's go then. And soon some orderlies showed up and put me on a gurney, and I waved my fingers at my mother, and they took me into one large elevator after another. It was dark in the hallways and in the elevators. Everything seemed very dim. I had not left my room at night before. I had not seen that night was different than day, even in the hospital. After a very long trip and many turns, I was pushed into a room and someone put a small tube into my arm and another small tube down my throat. Hold still, they said. I couldn't even nod. After a long time, but what I mean by that, I don't know in real time or terms. I was pushed into the CAT scan circle, and there were some clicks, and then it went dead. Shit, said a voice behind me. For another long time I lay there. The machine's broken, the voice said, but we need this scan or the doctor will kill us. I lay there a long time, and I was very cold. I learned that hospitals are often cold. I was shivering, but no one noticed. I'm sure they would have brought me a blanket. They only wanted the machine to work, and I understood that. Finally, I was pushed through, and there were the right-sounding clicks and tiny red lights blinking, and then the tube was taken out of my throat, and I was pushed out into the hallway. This is the memory I think I will never forget. My mother was sitting in the dark waiting area there in the deep basement of that hospital. Her shoulders slumped slightly in fatigue, but sitting with all the seeming patience in the world. Mommy, I whispered, and she waved her fingers. How did you ever find me?
Wasn't easy, she said, but I have a tongue in my head and I used it.
The next morning, toothache brought with her the news that the tests had come out all right, that in spite of what had shown up in my blood, the CAT scan was okay. The doctor would explain it all later. Toothache had also brought with her a gossip magazine, and she asked my mother if she'd like to read it. My mother shook her head quickly, as though she'd been asked to handle a person's private body parts. I'd like it, I told Toothache, holding out my hand. And she gave it to me, and I thanked her. The magazine lay that morning on my bed. Then I put it into the drawer in my table that had the telephone on it, and I did that, hid it, in case the doctor came in. So I was like my mother. We did not want to be judged by what we read. And while she wouldn't even read such a thing, I only didn't want to be seen with it. This strikes me as odd, so many years later. I was in the hospital. Essentially, so was she. What better time to read anything that takes the mind away? I had a few books from home near my bed, though I had not read them with my mother there, nor had she looked at them. But about the magazine, I'm sure it would not have made any dent in my doctor's heart. But that is how sensitive we both were, my mother and I. There is that constant judgment in this world. How are we going to make sure we do not feel inferior to another? It was merely a magazine about movie stars, one my own girls and I, when they were older, would look at for fun if we needed time to go by. And this particular magazine often featured a story about an ordinary person who had suffered something extraordinarily awful. When I took the magazine from the drawer that afternoon, I saw an article about a woman who had gone into a barn in Wisconsin to find her husband one evening and had her arm chopped off, literally chopped with an axe, by a man who had gotten out of the state mental asylum. This happened while her husband, tied to a post by the horse pens, watched. He screamed, which made the horses scream, and I guess the woman must have screamed like crazy. It did not say she passed out. And the sound of such noises caused the escaped from the asylum man to run off. The woman, who easily could have bled to death as her arteries were spurting blood, managed to call for help. And a neighbor came right over and tied her arm with a tourniquet. And now the husband and wife and neighbor made a point of starting each day by praying together. There was a photo of them in the early morning sun by the barn door in Wisconsin, and they were praying. The woman prayed with her one remaining arm and hand. They were hoping to get her a prosthetic soon, but there was the issue of money. I told my mother I thought it was bad taste to photograph people praying, and she said the entire thing was bad taste. "He's a lucky husband, though," she said in a few moments. "I see on the news those shows where a man might have to watch his wife be raped." I put the magazine down. I looked at my mother at the foot of my bed, this woman I had not seen for years. "Seriously?" I asked. "Seriously, what? A man watched his wife be raped? What were you watching, Mom?" I didn't add what I most wanted to. "And when did you guys get a TV?" "I saw it on television. I just told you that." "But on the news or one of those cop show things?" I felt I saw her considering this. And she said, "The news. One night at Vicky's house, somewhere in one of those awful countries." Her eyes flipped shut. I picked the magazine back up and rustled through it. I said, "Hey, look. This woman has a pretty gown. Mom, look at this pretty gown." But she did not respond or open her eyes. This is how the doctor found us that day. "Girls," he said, then stopped when he saw my mother with her eyes closed. He stayed just within the door, he and I both watching for a moment to see if my mother was truly asleep or if she would open her eyes. That moment, both of us watching to see, made me recall how in my youth there were times that I wanted desperately to run to a stranger when we went into town and say, "You need to help me, please." Please, can you please get me out of there? Bad things are going on. And yet I never did, of course. Instinctively, I knew that no stranger would help, no stranger would dare to, and that in the end, such a betrayal would make things far worse. And so now I turned from watching my mother to watching my doctor. For in essence, this was the stranger I had hoped for. And he turned and must have seen something on my face, and I, so briefly, felt I saw something on his, and he held up a hand to indicate he'd come back, and when he stepped out, I felt myself dropping into something familiar and dark from long ago. My mother's eyes remained shut for many more minutes. To this day, I have no idea if she was sleeping or just staying away from me. I wanted terribly to talk to my little children then. But if my mother was asleep, I couldn't wake her by speaking into the phone next to the bed. And also, the girls would have been in school. All day I had wanted to speak to my girls. I could barely stand it. So I pushed my apparatus out into the hallway and asked the nurses if I could make a call from their desk. And they pushed a phone toward me, and I called my husband. I was desperate not to have any tears drip from my eyes. He was at work, and he felt bad for me, hearing how much I missed him and the kids. "I'll call the sitter and have her call you just as soon as they're home. Chrissy has a play date today." So life goes on, I thought. And now I think it goes on until it doesn't. I had to sit in a chair at the nurse's station while I tried not to cry. Toothache put her arm around me, and even now I love her for that. I have sometimes been sad that Tennessee Williams wrote that line for Blanche DuBois, "I have always depended on the kindness of strangers." Many of us have been saved many times by the kindness of strangers. But after a while, it sounds trite, like a bumper sticker, and that's what makes me sad. That a beautiful and true line comes to be used so often that it takes on the superficial sound of a bumper sticker. I was wiping my face with my bare arm when my mother came to find me, and we all, Toothache, myself, the other nurses, waved to her. "I thought you were napping," I said, as she and I went back to my room. She said that she had been napping. "The sitter may call soon," I said, and I told her how Chrissy had a play date. "What's a play date?" my mother asked. I was glad we were alone. "It just means she's going to someone's house after school." "Who's the play date with?" my mother asked, and I felt that her asking was her way of being nice after what she must have seen in my face, my sadness. As we walked down the hallway of the hospital, I told her about Chrissy's friend, how the mother taught fifth grade and the father was a musician but also a jerk, kind of, and they were not happy in their marriage, but the girls seemed to like each other a great deal, and my mother nodded throughout all this. When we got back to my room, the doctor was there. His face was businesslike as he swished the curtain and pressed on my scar. He said brusquely, "About the scare last night, an inflammation was showing up in the blood and we needed the CAT scan. Get your fever down, keep some solid food down, and we can send you home." His voice was different enough that he might have slapped me with each word. I said, "Yes, sir," and did not look at him. I have learned this. A person gets tired. The mind or the soul or whatever word we have for whatever is not just the body gets tired. And this, I have decided, is usually, mostly, nature helping us. I was getting tired. I think, but I don't know, that he was getting tired too.
The sitter called. She was just a young girl, and she kept assuring me that the kids were doing fine. She held the phone to Becca's ear.